Hey, everyone. Welcome to VOA's Asia Weekly podcast for Friday, the 3rd of June. I'm Steve Miller in Washington, and thank you so much for joining me this week. Now, coming up in the podcast, North Korea. This week, they've been accused of money laundering, involvement in the Swift banking heist, and have failed to launch yet another missile. As the DPRK continues to defy the international community, some are wondering, are sanctions working? Plus, Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak's government has thrown its support behind a very controversial bill that would see punishment expanded in Islamic courts. What does that mean for the country? But first, what's the state of press freedom in Asia? And where could you find yourself in trouble for blogging or posting on social media? For many, the notion of working for a newspaper, or for that matter, blogging, rarely conjures up imagery of a dangerous profession, where one's personal freedom and safety are at risk. However, in countries like the Philippines, journalists are routinely targeted. Since 2010, 30 journalists have been killed, and not a single suspect has been apprehended. In fact, President-elect Rodrigo Duterte has said this week that it's okay to kill so-called corrupt journalists, something has been met with immediate condemnation. But it's not just professional journalists that face dangers around the globe. Those writing blogs or posting on social media have also been hauled into court, like 17-year-old Amos Yee in Singapore, who has once more found his way into the courtroom and is facing multiple charges. So if we look across Asia, what's the landscape of free speech and press freedom look like?
Although there's no regional homogeneity for the Asia-Pacific region.
That's Benjamin Ismail, head of the Asia-Pacific desk for Reporters Without Borders.
There are some similarities between countries of very different nature that do pose a concern. And one of them is the growing invocation of internal security, national security, public order, national defense. These expressions that refer to security and to the country's stability in order to muzzle news providers.
Ismail says that both media professionals and bloggers are being targeted by these provisions. But perhaps what's most alarming is that it isn't just developing countries or those under the control of military juntas that have these restrictions.
You have countries like Japan, Australia, South Korea, which have democracies and also repressive countries such as China, Vietnam, or now Thailand under the military regime, who are invoking arguments of the same nature from the same pool of wordings and of legal terms in order to muzzle critics and dissent voices.
He says that while this is an observable trend, it's also important to note that the actual working conditions and situations vary from one nation to the next. However, there are themes present within the region, like violence towards journalists, as seen in places like India, Pakistan, and the Philippines.
Then there might be another group of countries formed by the countries under communist repressive regime. So you have Vietnam, Laos, China, and North Korea, where you have very tight control of online media. There is no real independent press or the traditional media, the broadcasting and the print media.
Ismail notes that there are nuances across these countries.
But all these communist countries or these repressive regime are conducting similar strategies in terms of control of information, in terms of reprisal against critical voices, and are also using masquerades trials in order to justify in the eye of the international community the growing arrest and the jail terms that are the imprisonment that are distributed to news providers and independent bloggers or cyber activists.
He says that while it may be difficult to predict what directions governments will take with regards to restrictions on free speech and prosecutions.
There is a movement from the civil society, from international organizations, that is taking more and more aware of this concerning trend, and that is trying to have the government modifying the policies and using less this pretext in order to silence dissident voices.
Unfortunately, Ismail notes, many of these countries continue to justify their stances by claiming it further protects national security. But what about blogging in general? Where does Reporters Without Borders see concern?
Recently, we have been concerned by countries like Malaysia and Singapore. In both those countries, the prime minister themselves, so Najib in Malaysia or Lee Hsien Loong in Singapore, have been personally involved in reprisals against independent bloggers and critical bloggers. That shows not only the spirit, the fear, the fact that they believe that such criticism can put into question their legitimacy or their actions while they are heading the government.
Because, as Ismail puts it, they're conducting these activities
without fear of being really criticized by the international community.
He also identified Thailand, which under the military junta has seen an uptick in Les Majestés cases, as one area of concern, as well as Bangladesh. So what can bloggers do to protect themselves? Reporters Without Borders' Benjamin Ismail says that while professional journalists must often use their real names when reporting, bloggers can enjoy some degree of anonymity by using pen names. He acknowledges that sometimes that does mean a trade-off in establishing credibility, but could provide some safety. Another way, he says, is to alert authorities. However, it is important to note that governments have a finite number of personnel at their disposal, meaning they can't have a police officer guarding every journalist or blogger. But when it comes to repeated threats and following through on investigations after crimes have been committed,
if all the bloggers, if all the journalists gather and go together as one man in front of the authorities and request for security measures to be provided by the government, it is a duty of the government to do so and to protect its citizens.
If you write or post on social media sites, I'd love to know if you have felt any pressure to censor yourself or have been threatened. So please reach out and share your stories with me. North Korea has once more made headlines this past week, and not just once either. First, North Korea warned that any South Korean warship that passes the northern limit line, which is the maritime border between South and North Korea and the Yellow Sea, would be fired upon. Then researchers at Symantec, a cybersecurity powerhouse, noted that the same tools used in the massive SWIFT banking hack and theft were the same that were previously traced back to North Korea after the Sony Pictures Entertainment attack and others dating back to 2009. Now that's a pretty big deal, since the SWIFT banking security system is thought by many to be the most secure in the world. And finally, the DPRK looks to have attempted once more to launch a medium-range Musudan missile. And like the three before it, the rocket failed. When you add in the fact that North Korea could conduct a fifth nuclear test at any time, a reasonable question to ask is, are North Korean sanctions effective?
Well, they are raising the cost to North Korean behavior.
That's Daniel Pinkston, lecturer in international relations at Troy University's global campus located in Seoul, South Korea.
We have to have realistic expectations about sanctions, and we also have to be mindful that they are also a signal to third-party observers. So North Korea is an outlier state, and their behavior, I believe, must be met with consequences.
Melissa Hannum is a senior research associate at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey.
Well, I think the sanctions that have been in place in the past, it's been kind of a mixed bag. We've definitely found that North Korea is extremely creative when it comes to evading sanctions. We've seen really elaborate schemes to transship through third, fourth countries in order to get the items they need. And we've seen quite a bit of money laundering.
Hannum studies satellite imagery, and says that in part due to China's participation in these latest sanctions.
I can really see differences in maritime traffic and changes that are going on there. However, this 2016 year has been remarkably active for North Korea, and I think we're still going to have a fair amount of time play out before we really know how big an impact it's made.
Pinkston notes that if there were no consequences for North Korea after tests such as these by the international community, then that may in turn embolden other actors to pursue similar programs. In other words, even if the probability of success for those sanctions isn't that great,
I still think it's important to impose those sanctions to be clear that there are costs and that it will be costly for North Korea to continue on this path.
But with the continued push by the DPRK to develop nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missiles, some have questioned if the continued use of sanctions is an appropriate strategy. Troy University's Daniel Pinkston says that there are essentially three options when dealing with North Korea.
One is to use force and disarm North Korea, but that would be a very costly war, and it would unleash all the types of things that we wish to avoid. The second option would be just to acquiesce and give North Korea everything it wants. So I don't think that second option is realistic. And the third option is deterring and containing North Korea pending some internal change. But we have to play the long game for that.
Going beyond that, Pinkston says that the international community must work together to present a strong military deterrence and be willing to use it if necessary. He also says that the world must band together to ensure that the economic sanctions take hold. And finally, that the DPRK doesn't achieve a level of prestige associated with being a nuclear state. But with the alleged link between North Korea and high-profile hacks like Sony Pictures and the Swift banking heist, is Pyongyang's cybersecurity threat a greater risk than its missile or nuclear programs? Again, the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, Melissa Hannum.
I think they're both important and they're both interlinked. Cyber and nuclear systems are linked all over the world. For North Korea, cyber is a really powerful tool because it's asymmetric. You know, for a country with a low human capital costs, it's really easy to build up a force of people who are educated in these types of tactics and can carry out these attacks from within and without of the North Korean state borders. Nuclear is a much heavier lift, but the consequences of nuclear are very, very strong. And so I don't know if you can say one way or another. I mean, traditionally, we say nuclear is the biggest threat, but you know, the cyber attacks on not only banks, but also different security systems around the world make them pretty risky. The traditional thought is that cyber is a weapon of mass disruption rather than destruction. But nuclear security is deeply linked with cyber these days. No one lives in a bubble. And so I think cyber is going to become more and more important.
So what about you? What are you most concerned about? North Korea's desire to develop and possess weapons of mass destruction, or their ability to hack into computer systems beyond their borders? Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak's government threw its support behind an Islamic penal code bill that includes amputations and stoning. It was a move that shocked some of his political allies and stoked fears of further strains in the multi-ethnic country. Mr. Najib's critics believe he's using hudud, or Islamic law, to shore up support of Muslim voters and stave off any political attacks before by-elections next month and the general election in 2018. The hudud bill was proposed by the Islamic group Parti Islam Se Malaysia's, and while the bill has been tabled until October, its introduction brought with it a fair amount of criticism, including that of the Barisan National Coalition, who represent the Chinese and Indian communities. The United Malays National Organization, or the UMNO party, said the new bill only pertains to certain offenses, comes under the jurisdiction of the Sharia court system, and only is applicable to Muslims. They say it has nothing to do with non-Muslims. Mr. Najib said those objecting to the bill misunderstood it and that the punishments would only be limited to canings and would not injure or even draw blood. The Malaysian Chinese Association called the submission of the bill unconstitutional, and in fact, several non-Muslim ministers have pledged to resign if the bill goes through. Brad Adams is the executive director of Human Rights Watch's Asia Division.
Malaysia has basically been in free fall for the past year. The Prime Minister, Najib, has been under intense pressure because of a corruption scandal.
He says that because of the corruption scandal and resulting investigation,
the government is now using very broad and vague laws, including the sedition law and other laws, to charge people who have simply engaged in commentary on the corruption scandal or criticized the government for other things like imprisoning the opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim.
But this latest development, the support for expansion of Sharia laws,
it's a pretty shocking development because this is something that the ruling party UMNO has always opposed. But now, for the survival of his coalition government, it seems that Najib is willing to sacrifice virtually any of his principles. Sharia itself isn't necessarily going to violate human rights standards. It always depends on how it's applied and how it's understood. But the more conservative political parties in Malaysia are stating publicly that they expect it to be applied in a very conservative way. So, for example, there is discussion now of the Hudud law being passed.
And in the short term, Adams says the proposed laws could have a negative effect on women's rights in Malaysia. And that is a concern because of the close proximity to Indonesia, where there have been regulations put in place banning women from certain activities like
being out at night unaccompanied by a male family member, or banning them from riding on motorcycles unless they sit sideways, which of course is very dangerous for women, and other things to basically bring the country back many generations so that it becomes a patriarchal society that's dominated by men where women are told what to do.
While it has been stated that the new laws would only apply to the country's Muslim population, Adam notes that in other countries, those restrictive laws have expanded to include other populations.
But frankly, I think that if applied to Muslims, that's enough of a concern. There's no reason why a Muslim woman should have fewer rights than a Hindu woman or a Christian woman in Malaysia, or a Buddhist woman if they're in the Chinese community. So I don't see that as the primary concern, that it would be applied to non-Muslims. It's that they would be applied to anybody.
Or other areas, like extra taxes or against people with different sexual orientations. Brad Adams says that unfortunately, what Human Rights Watch is starting to see is a trend for Malaysia to become more like Cambodia or Burma before their respective reform processes. Well, my friends, that's it for this week. Thank you so much for joining me. Now, if you enjoyed the podcast, please do me a huge favor and share it with your friends and family. And if you have any thoughts or opinions about any of the stories this week, I'd love to hear from you. So hit me up on Facebook or Twitter. I'm at Steve Miller VOA. And be sure to join our community Facebook page. It's called VOA Now. Now, to get every single new podcast delivered automatically to you, be sure to subscribe. It's quick, it's easy, and of course, best of all, absolutely free. Just go to voanews.com and click on the radio program page and look for VOA Asia Weekly. Again, thank you so much for your time this week. I really do appreciate it. In Washington, I'm Steve Miller. And until next time, be true to yourself and always be awesome.